right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. And we are in the heart of Jerusalem right now at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov. You know what that means? It means that it's time for a spiritual cafe. And of course, with us is none other than Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Welcome to Beit Midrash.
Yes, I'm happy to be in the Beit Midrash. It is a sunny yet rainy day, one of those days where you're like overdressed and underdressed. You have to have layers. You just can't wear a sweater because then you're going to be upset.
Thanks for making me feel bad about myself.
Yeah, no, because you can get a little bit hot. I'm actually wearing second pants, like an underpants, because it was like cold outside in the morning, and I don't like to be cold. Now it's a little bit hot. And I guess that's a metaphor for the challenges of this world, the challenges of decisiveness and doing things right. And this week's Torah portion is one really of the questions of doing things right within the family. And I think it's fair to say that this Torah portion, Vayeshev, in the book of Genesis, is a shift in gears. This is a different gear now. We learned about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But now we're with the kids. Now, how do I say it? Now it's like we're gonna delve into a painful saga. I think it's a painful saga for me. From here on end to the end of the book of Genesis, Bereshit is harder. It's harder to deal with it. It's a little bit more.
Is that because of the conflict?
There's a conflict there. Also, it's an internal Jewish conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem with conflict with them, the Gentiles, and the war with them. Okay. But when it's like your own brothers backstabbing you, and that's really the story we're going to learn. We're going to learn mm-hmm. the story of backstabbing. We're going to learn about a fantastic character named Joseph, who has, on the one hand, great qualities. He's a great organizer. He's a great visionary. He is a prophet of a different nature. He receives dreams and interprets dreams, and he will drive the rest of this book.
Mm-hmm.
He will drive the rest of this book, and yet there's something hard to swallow about Joseph.
Immature.
Immature, a little bit judgmental, a little bit haughty, or kind of, there's something unpleasant in certain words of his character, and his brothers find him to be unpleasant. And so a great movement is going to start here through the basic outline of the story is the selling of the Joseph, the brother, and the Egyptian exile is starting in this week's Torah portion. One could say that the prelude to the Egyptian exile starts here now.
It's certainly the first steps into Egypt.
All right, so let's talk about first the issues of dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us have dreams. Some of us don't remember our dreams. But dreams are playing a role here. The Bible, the Torah, is going to not only tell us that Joseph had dreams, but it's going to tell us the content of those dreams. So let's talk about dreams. Why is dream a mode of communication that Joseph has as opposed to others? What is this form of prophecy? And like, why does God reveal himself in these kind of mysterious, not clear messages from the heavens?
Well, first, it's important to really note that this is yet another thing that Joseph inherits from his father, because Yaakov really is the original dreamer in our story, right? But he's the one that lays down and has the...
But his dreams are like a vision, and he understands godliness, like the latter. Here, it's like a dream of like, this should happen, this will happen, I need to...
But leaving aside the content, when I heard you ask about what are dreams and what's the nature of this prophecy, and the reason I mention Yaakov is because it's extremely important to note that Yaakov, unlike his brother, is able to sleep. I don't know if you ever noticed that Esav is characterized as ayif v'yageya. He's like, he's weary and worn out. But Yaakov is the first person who we hear actually sleeps. And what's the connection between sleep and dreams, except aside from the obvious? And the answer is that it's a tremendous faith in going to sleep. Not just in the sense of physical safety, like when I'm asleep, you know, what's going to happen to me? And not just even in the sense of some sort of existential crisis of like, if I go to sleep, you know, like, will I ever wake up? It's on a deeper level, going to sleep is letting go of the need to create the world all by yourself. You know, have you ever had that moment where you say, it doesn't really matter how much I have to do right now. It's time to go to sleep.
Sure.
I'm handing it back over to God. And because Yaakov, despite the challenges that he faces, and his son Yosef, are able to go to sleep, they're able to dream. because they're able to have a vision of the world which is broader than their ability to put the pieces together and to construct some sort of like strategic plan of how it's all going to work out. It's that trust in God that says, just lay your head down and open yourself up to possibilities, as we say in English, of which you have not yet dreamed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that's the dream aspect in prophecy. It's the opening of a horizon which is not bounded by our abilities to do, but rather connects us to the larger part of the world in which we participate.
It's interesting because the way you're describing it, therefore going to sleep, is a certain humility, because you're saying, I don't control the world. I need to take a break. There's a bigger picture. And the message from God in the dream is also like, I'm now going to tell you the bigger picture because I'm the boss and I'm going to share it with you. So there's a certain bit of humility. Yet the irony there, or the tension, is that Joseph is not a person filled with humility, at least at the outset, at his kind of when we first meet him. His dreams are really of – he has dreams of superiority.
Well, that's why I use the word immature. I mean, I was thinking of immature like the Hebrew word boser, right? When you say that grapes are not yet ripe for the wine, the boser means that you take something which in a month or two is going to be sweet, delicious, it'll make fine wine. Right now, it'll make teeth hurt, right? Because everything that's there is there, but it's not in the right proportions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the right mix. And therefore, if you try to access its sweetness, it's not there yet. Yosef has to go through a very specific process of refinement that will take him from this seemingly somewhat snotty kid into Yosef HaTzadik, you know, the righteous visionary leader that he's to become.
One also has to forgive him a little bit because the dreams are not his. Well, that's the question. Are the dreams his? Are they self-generated from his psychology? Or as we are led to believe, or that's the way I understand at least the Torah, it's, no, these dreams are from on high, and they're directing him to do certain things. And he later on, he'll say to his brothers, you didn't sell me down here. It was God who wanted this whole story to take place so that we would go into the Egyptian exile. So he's following the dream that he's being given. And then I ask you on a personal psychological level, where do our dreams come from, right? And are we supposed to have a dream that's somehow generated from within? I sometimes struggle with that because I'm not sure I have a dream from within. And then you fill yourself with a dream from without. And Joseph, on the one hand, he seems to be full of confidence and, what did you call it, a little bit snotty. But on the other hand, his dreams seem to be from the outside, and he's taking steps to fulfill a mandate that's not his but God's.
Well, you know, the sages tell us that every dream is 1/60th prophecy. You know, and it's important that it's 1/60th because, of course, in legal terms, in halachic terms, 1 in 60 is nullified, right? If 1/60th pork fat falls into your soup, it's as if it doesn't exist.
If it fell in accidentally.
If it fell in accidentally, we
you cannot
put it
spice
in
it with 1/60th.
Right. Please don't misunderstand.
Right.
The rabbinic disclaimer. Right. But why do I mention it? It's because 1/60th, it doesn't exist, but it does. It's there, but it doesn't count. Right. And so I think in our lives, right, the beautifully, as you said, does the dream come from within or without? I mean, part of dreaming is simply the fact that we're taking in massive amounts of information and observations all day long that we can't really process,
mm-hmm.
and both sort of physically and emotionally and psychologically. And it comes out at night. But there's another piece, I believe, which is that part of that laying down and willingness to go to sleep and shut down the external senses is the ability for the soul to emerge. You know, the soul is very shy.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it doesn't come out easy.
It comes out at night.
It comes out at night, right? And to the extent that the soul is able to grasp what it is that we offer it from our daily experience, it can communicate to us that piece of the divine that was within us. You know, this is why the book of Jeremiah. I mean, Jeremiah, definitely a prophet, right? We all agree. And it wasn't even his prophecies weren't generally in dreams. It seems they were in actually waking visions. And yet there's an amazing, amazing teaching at the beginning of the book when God says to him, Jeremiah, what do you see? You remember what I'm speaking about? And he says, oh, I see Makil Shakid. I see an almond branch. And God says, oh, you saw well. And then he uses a sort of a Hebrew wordplay to explain to him that God is Shakid. He's waiting to, you know, bring this evil quickly. So the question is, why? The answer is because the prophet is not an empty vessel for prophecy. He is its medium. right? Except for Moshe, who is of a different category, right? The prophet is its medium. He's the stuff through which vision passes, and so therefore the dreams function the same way. And to the extent that we can let go and let our soul speak to us in the night, that 1/60th of prophecy, which is there, I believe, can reemerge. And what Yosef was struggling with is that he was way more than 1/60th. I mean, he was Yosef at Tzaddik. He was the righteous. He's not like you or I. And so therefore, what was trying to come out was well beyond his capacity in the waking world to really handle. I mean, you ever wonder, why did he go tell his brothers? I don't think it was simply because he was like the obnoxious little brother like I was once and wanted to make them feel bad. I think because when he would wake up, these dreams would be so present for him, he had to tell someone. I mean, that's part of the feeling of prophecy that we see elsewhere. Jeremiah, again, describes it like a fire burning in his bones. He can't hold back.
And the prophets weren't always liked. They weren't always appreciated.
Certainly not.
You know, they were, on some levels, they were intellectuals. Giving their pundits, in a sense, giving a different perspective on how we should run society. And the powers, and usually it was critical.
Yes.
And so the powers that be would chase them, would try to kill them, would imprison them, wouldn't want to hear them, certainly. Not everybody got the status that Abraham had amongst the Gentiles, that they saw him as a prince amongst us. A lot of times the prophet was seen as this thorn in your sight. It's certainly Joseph is seen as a thorn, even to the point that it is his own father in this week's Torah portion kind of like, growls.
Shuts him up.
Yeah, shuts him up. And he's like, you know, what are we all going to come bow down to you? Because his first two dreams are really about people bowing down to him and him being the superior, the leader. And he understands somehow that he's, I don't know if he understands, but later on he's going to understand that that he's got to make these visions come to be. Mm-hmm. That's another step. You have a dream. Famously, Herzl said, "Im tirtzu ein zo agada." If you will, it is no. We translate dream, but it's not a legend.
Right. It's not a myth.
It's not a myth. Like he takes his dreams and he makes them. He wants to actualize those dreams. What tells him that?
So I think that's because these dreams are not like. How to say it? You know, there's always a temptation to dismiss dreams and our dream life
right.
as something other than the real world.
The pragmatic world.
Right. And I think that's the difference between people who change the world and people who just sort of do the best they can within the world which they're given.
Struggle to make it.
Exactly. Right. Well, and even do good things. But the key is they struggle to do the best they can within the world as given.
Right.
And a real prophet, visionary, dreamer, their dreams drive them to change the world, not just to do more within it. And that's what lies ahead for Yosef. And so he feels like these are not dreams that are telling him what to do. These are dreams that tell him to change the world.
Right. But the way he's going to go about it is not necessarily through a step-by-step process. Ironically, it's his very dreams and the way that he says them that is going to lead to his exile from the family. It's going to lead his brothers to throw him into a pit. And that pit, they were first going to kill him. And then they were going to... He so drove his brothers insane that he was exiled from his family, and then they went so far as to lie to their own father to give that famous Technicolor dream coat to Yaakov, now bloodstained with the blood of an animal. And they were going to put their father in unspeakable pain. Maybe a midah keneged midah,
measure for measure,
for him seeking out the love of Joseph more than the other brothers.
Or for deceiving his own father with the skin of a goat.
Right.
Right. So much of this story, if you read the rabbinic sort of subtext, is about how the life that we live is not just about our lives. It's a playing out of generational tensions. Right? That's a great example, is that the brothers bring this blood-soaked coat. They kill a goat, and they soak the coat in his blood, and they bring it to Yaakov. And as Rashi brings in the rabbinic narrative in his fashion, he says, oh yeah, Yaakov, you deceived your father with a goat. You know, you put the hair of the goat on your arm so that you could get Esau's bracha. Here you go. Measure for measure. Your sons will deceive you with a goat. And then even earlier when it says Yaakov wants to send him, it's amazing. I mean, for your new job, this is a great reference, right? Yaakov sends him Emek Hebron, right, from the Valley of Hebron. So Rashi says, wait a minute, we all know that Hebron's not a mountain, even though today we can know that it's actually both, right? So it's not Emek, read it as Eitza Amukah. It's the deep, deep plan of that righteous person buried in Hebron. What's that referring to?
Abraham.
Abraham and the whole prophecy that they're playing out, that his children will be strangers in a strange land.
Right. Again, so Mi'emek Hebron means from the depths of Hebron. And Rashi explains it, and I saw that it was in the Talmud. I actually just – we recently passed it in the Daf Yomi. The deep – not the depths of Hebron, but the deep ideas of Hebron. Mm-hmm. That's definitely –
which is that the life we're living now is rooted in our ancestors' actions. And that,
and that was a dream also.
Yes.
That was a dream also.
For sure.
That's the dream of the Brit Ben of Tarim, the covenant between the parts where Abraham gets like knocked out.
Listen,
and he gets told that the children are going to go into exile.
Aren't you and I living out the dreams of our ancestors right now?
Absolutely.
I mean, I always say that you know, you could go back more than one generation in my family, and every single person that I could think of would have crawled on their hands and knees until they were bleeding to be where we're sitting right now.
Well, maybe another important thing to realize when you're living life is that you are living, hopefully, somebody else's dream. Sometimes, sadly, we live out somebody else's nightmare here with the terrorism, but we are living a dream of generations. And that, by the way, is oftentimes missing in our brothers and sisters here in Israel and abroad, where we forget that we're part of a great story, a great narrative, a great dream, and that we're fulfilling it with our lives. And in our own hustle and bustle, we can forget, you know, that dream sequence that we're in, and certainly the coming to fruition of this greatest dream of the ingathering.
You know, it's not just the hustle and bustle as well. I think it's the desire for all of us to believe that we're in control of our own lives. You know, I mean, living somebody else's dream is a lot of responsibility. It's also a sense of where's my agency. You see this, you know, when Yosef goes down into Egypt, here he was as close as he could be to his father. Suddenly his brothers jump him, throw him in the pit. Okay, we could say not so suddenly. He knew that they hated him, right? And they sell him down into Egypt, and everything goes his way, right? Calls him Ish Matzliach. He is a successful guy. And his new master doesn't just see him as a slave. He sees him as the head of his household. He puts him in charge, and immediately, what does he start to do? He starts to curl his hair, eat good food, you know, drink nice wine. Why? He knows his father is back there suffering, his brothers. He knows about the prophecy of Abraham and the whole mission of the people. And you know what he's saying at this point? Don't bother me with that. I want to live the good life. You know, and he pays for it.
When that's right. When you forget the good life kept coming after him, so much so that his master's wife, who is the goodest of lives, she's rich and she's beautiful and she's powerful and she's coming on to him,
mm-hmm.
right? And she's coming on to him. It's like, you know, he even had a vision, according to some commentators, that maybe this is the pathway towards his power and success that he was supposed to have.
Yeah.
Maybe she's the way. Interestingly, I heard a great Torah about how he knew that she was actually bad news.
How's that?
It says, "Vayhi kedabra el Yosef yom yom." It was that she spoke to him day after day, and then it says, "Velo shamaleh." He didn't listen to her
desire.
What's the word? Her advances. The words "yom yom" is the analysis of this Hasidic rabbi who said. He said, listen, Yosef realized, at first he thought maybe this is it, but then when he realized that this Eshet Potiphar is starting with him every single day, he knew that it was a Yetzer Hara, because only the Yetzer Hara starts with you every day. Yetzer Tov, from time to time, like a window opens, an opportunity happens, and okay, you run through. But something that's nudging you every day, that's only Yetzer Hara. Right. That's only Yetzer Hara.
Only the Yetzer Hara never takes a break.
By the way, speaking of Eshet Potiphar, this foreign woman who's coming on to Yosef and she's bothering him every day. I have I want to be sensitive about the next thing I'm going to say, but you know, laugh with me a little bit as I say this, a little bit in jest, but a little bit in truth, which is I used to call New York City my Eshet Potiphar. She always calls me, come live this good life here. You can. The thing about New York City, which is so incredible, is that it's actually a super welcoming town. Mm-hmm. Unlike what people tell you, it's democratic. It'll let you in. You are cool enough. You never. When you go to Paris, you might be like, "I'm not cool enough for this city." New York is like, "Yes, you are, son. Come in, be a part of this great big apple, right?" And when I was living in New York, and it was time to move to Eretz Yisrael, you know, it wasn't like, I wasn't one of those people that was like, blech, gullus, I'm out of here. It wasn't like that at all. You know, there's something to New York City. There's a tremendous power and you know, energy, the feeling that you're at the center of the world. And sometimes there are things in this world. It could be, by the way, your eshet potifar might be food. Mm-hmm. Right, like that you walk past an English cake store here or a bakery, and you just cannot deny yourself. Or that eshet potifar might be television, or going to some website that you shouldn't be going to. There's a lot of eshet potifars out there. They're things that they're calling you, they're beckoning at you, and grabbing at you and pulling you in, and you've got to fight them. And what Yosef did is that he let go of his beged. In her hand, he let go of the materialism that he had, the things that were holding him back, and he just dropped it. He gave it to Eshet Potifar, this lady. By the way, interesting that she doesn't even have a name. She's the wife, right? So my point is that we all have our different Eshet Potifars, and at least we have to know them. At least we have to say, okay, you know what? My Eshet Potifar is this television set.
So let's play this out for a second, because it really speaks to me. The Midrash, you know, the rabbinic commentary says that actually there was a moment when Yosef was going to give in.
He was coming home to do his work.
He was coming home to do his business, as they say. And you got to remember that he's been curling his hair. He's wearing Egyptian perfumes and fine linens, right? He looks like an Egyptian. And
Walks like an Egyptian,
right? And when in Egypt, you do as the Egyptians do, and this is what they do. And it says, in the moment when he was about to give in, he looked up and he saw his father's face in the window.
Now, In a reflection.
Although, let's leave aside the fact that likely they didn't have glass panes in their windows.
You know what Rabbi Rav Sabato says?
What's that?
He says that she dragged him into like a bedroom where she had like polished
mirrors. I like that, because I've always wondered. But wait, listen to this. So way back at the beginning of the Parsha, we saw that Yaakov loved Yosef more than his other sons, which is, as a parent, a big problem, right? And Rashi brings several reasons why he might have loved him. And you know what one of the reasons he gives is? That Yosef looked like him. Yosef looked like Yaakov. And you know, as a father, it's special. You look at the kid, looks like me, you know? Sweet, he's like the little me. So what does this mean that he looked like Yaakov? And then in the moment of truth, when he decides not to give in to this other desire, he looks up and he sees his father's face in the window. You know what he saw in the window? He saw himself. But he saw through that false identity that he draped on himself with the curled hair and the linens. And he saw his father within him and realized who he really was. And I think that really is the core of how we resist, whether it's New York City or food or other temptations, right? It's a question of, oh, is this who I really am? Because if I decide this is who I really am, then I can resist almost anything because it's simply not me. You know, and even if I stumble and fail, and as we all do, nevertheless, I don't let my failures define me. And that was the critical moment, I think, that when he saw his father's face, when he saw his face as his father and not as an Egyptian, that was when he gained the power to truly be Yosef HaTzadik.
That's very good. You're saying your true self. I think another way of saying that is you also see that your true self is part of a chain. Mm-hmm. And you say he also saw his father and himself as his father. And then later his children, meaning to say he saw the generations that he was from Abraham and what they would be. And the other mode is seeing yourself as just yourself. Sure, then carpe diem and give vent to all carnal lusts and temptations.
Because only the moment matters.
Right, and only you matter.
Right.
You're not part of something bigger.
That's right.
So he understood that he was part of something bigger. Hidden in this Torah portion, and by the way, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem. We first want to thank our good friend Jack, who dedicates the show to Lillian, and also Sister Sarah, and blesses them that God will direct them. And also my good friend Andrew, who loves this show, loves Spiritual Cafe. A lot of people really love Spiritual Cafe. And it's also now featured prominently on the Sulam Yaakov SoundCloud.
Yep.
And
find us on iTunes and on Stitcher.
That is big. That is big stuff. The Stitcher stuff is good. And so therefore, I'm very happy that this show is getting spread out even more. And I think it's the Torah within it that needs to be spread even further. and the story of Jerusalem and the story of Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, and it needs to just get out there. This Torah needs to get out further, and I know that listening to it myself has helped me live a deeper, more meaningful life. Hidden within this Torah portion also is my favorite, one of my favorites, top three or four parts of the Torah, if you're allowed to say such a thing, and that is the story of Yehuda and Tamar, Judah and Tamar, biblical story par excellence. You know, this is where the magic happens. this is where the magic happens. Judah, the brother, the lion king of the brothers. You know, and he loses it a little bit, having a midlife crisis. Screwed up a little bit by allowing the brother to get sold. Father, family's broken. Father is in a bad way. And he kind of needs to take a break. He befriends a Gentile of sorts, marries a girl. She dies. And I'm guessing that he's in a midlife crisis of sorts.
That speak to you?
Listen, you know what I mean? We all go through it. And he's traveling along the way, where he sees, where unbeknownst to him, his daughter-in-law, who was given. Oh, I forgot to mention, he has two sons. They both die mysteriously. A third son is left alive. The first son that was born was married to this lady Tamar, and Tamar, she's this special lady. But this first son named Er, he seems not to want to consummate properly their relationship. He spills seed in order not to impregnate her, seemingly. And then probably the brother does the same thing. Onan, Er v'Onan, they are the kind of quintessential sinners of not fulfilling the commandment of procreation in the fullest manner of it, of maybe being, in a sense, Greco-Roman in the yearning to enjoy.
Once again, the pleasure of the moment.
The pleasure of the moment.
Without the commitment to the future.
Exactly. Yehuda doesn't want to give his last and third son to Tamar. He thinks she's the problem. Right? He thinks she might be the...
It's a story about all of his mistakes, so you can just add that one.
Right, she's a man-killer, right?
Right.
And nothing could be further from the truth. But anyway, Tamar... She is one special Jewish lady, and she hears that her father-in-law is going somewhere to shear his sheep. She gets up there before he does, waits at the intersection, and drapes her, kind of covers her face, and acts, I guess, like a harlot, pretends to be a harlot. And Judah, this biblical, rabbinic, Jewish, awesome figure, is like, oh, look, a harlot. Great. I really want to hang out with you. And offers her these. She asks him, "Well, what will you pay me?" And he says, "Well, the payment will be sheep, but for now, I could give you my signet ring, my cloak, and my staff." She says, "Okay." And whatever happens, happens. She becomes pregnant, and within 3 months, she starts to show. And a little voice comes to Judah's. Somebody tells Judah, "Your daughter-in-law is a harlot, and she has gotten pregnant to harlotry." And he says, "Sure, well, the law is burn her at the stake." And then she sends these the signet ring and the cloak and the staff to Judah and says, "I am pregnant to who these objects belong." And he, instead of being a politician and saying, "I don't know what she's talking about, let her burn," he admits it publicly and says, "Yes, she's pregnant because of me, and I understand now what she was doing." And they have these twins, and these twins, basically, Peretz is the forefather of Mashiach, of King David's lineage. What a crazy biblical story. Commentary, please.
Well, before I get into the commentary, why is it your favorite story?
I think it's got everything. I think it's got, first thing, it's got deception. It's got sexuality. It's got Mashiach. It's got it's also a hidden story. You find a lot of times that
it's tucked into the narrative.
It's tucked into the narrative, and you'll speak to a lot of Jews who aren't so connected. They've never heard of the story, mm-hmm. And yet if they would hear the story and they would see how beautiful the Bible is and how it's so rich and
it's complex.
It's complex and it's messianic. There's within this whole story is this like, it's like the behind the scenes of Mashiach, the making. Remember the book of the making of a tzaddik, the making of a gadol. That's what it was. The making of a gadol. This is the making of Mashiach, and it's got to be done in the darkest, most filthy seeming places to make Mashiach happen.
Which is consistent, you realize, because of course. This is one of the three stories I can think of off the top of my head that involve, let's just say, questionable sexual practices in the line of Mashiach. Right? The first one is that Ruth, who becomes really the mother of kingship of Malchut, right, when she marries Boaz later in, during the time of the Judges, she's a descendant of Moab, who is a descendant of a daughter who sleeps with her father.
That's Lot's daughters.
Lot's daughters. Right? And then we have the story of Tamar and Yehudah, where she basically deceives her.
From this week's Torah portion.
From this week's Torah portion, where she deceives her father-in-law into sleeping with her, and she has Peretz, who is going to begin that process. And then there's the third story, which is David himself in, let's just say, a questionable relationship with Bathsheba, right? From which comes Solomon and the continuation of his line. So the question is, why is it that Mashiach seems to be so clouded with moral ambiguity? And to make it worse, by the way, you know, historically, throughout the world, the firstborn inherits. We discussed this a little bit with Yaakov and Esav, and like, who's the firstborn there? Esav comes out first, Yaakov is holding his heel, right? But Yaakov has to, you know, buy the birthright, and he switches the brachot. So here, with Peretz and Zerach, there's an amazing story. You didn't tell like the really strange end of the story. It's that Tamar gets pregnant with twins, right? And as she's about to give birth, one of the twins sticks his hand out of the womb. And the midwife ties a red string around and says, we'll know that that one was actually the firstborn. Then suddenly, the hand pulls back. A baby is born with no red string on his hands. And the nurse calls him Peretz because, like, my paratzta, like you broke through, you pushed your brother out of the way. And then the baby with the red string is born second, which in Peretz is the line of Mashiach, which means Mashiach is actually born first from her womb, but he's not the firstborn. So what on earth is going on? What is this dynamic? And I think it speaks so deeply. The only way I can explain it is it's Shabbat. It's the nature of Shabbat. You know, Shabbat is the seventh day of the week. It's the last day of the week. But we say, Sof Maaseh B'machshava Techila. It was the last act, but it was the original intention. Meaning, you have to have the 6 days of the week. Just like, you know, there are six experiential directions. You look in front of you, behind you, above you, below you, left, right. There's you in the middle. That's the seventh point. That seventh point was always there, but you couldn't find it until you defined the other six, right? You follow me? In the same way, Shabbat was always the intention of holiness in time, but you had to go through those other 6 days to have it emerge. In the same way that Mashiach, this redemptive consciousness, please let it be soon, let it be now, right? It was fully the intention of creation, but it can't be front-loaded. It has to emerge out of the processes of human building and suffering and moral ambiguity and all the struggles that real life offers, because then it'll have full meaning. If God had just given it to us in the beginning, then our struggles would be meaningless. Our dreams and our sweats and our failures and our building would be meaningless. There has to be this sense that it's particularly through stories like this, which are gritty and real, and that's what I heard in what you were saying about why it's such a beautiful thing in the Bible. It's not beautiful because it's classical Greek. No, it's beautiful because it's gritty. It's real.
There's another element which I think is very prevalent here, which is the two men that were married to Tamar, they didn't want to carry forward, as we were saying, the responsibility or pass the line, the lineage, this amazing DNA code, mm-hmm. the amazing to be a son of Yehudah. It's like the most incredible thing. They didn't want that opportunity. But Tamar, she is the exact opposite. She is desperate. She's not having a thrill with Yehudah. She wants a seed.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to procreate in the most real of senses. And she is out there being, what is her trickiness? It's the same trickiness of Yaakov. Is it a trickiness in order to take your money?
No.
It's a trickiness to get the blessing. It's a trickiness to get your seed so that Mashiach can be born. She puts her life on the line. She puts her life on the line in order for the Jewish people to be perpetuated, and not for herself, the opposite of herself.
No, on the contrary. I mean, you know that Malchut, kingship, in the minds of the mystics, is a feminine aspect, right? Because it's because particularly of that, late Migarme Klumen has nothing of its own. Real kingship is not about itself. It's never self-serving. It's about being able to receive what the world offers and give it a context within which it can grow. Right, that's what the messianic leadership and consciousness, which is why Tamar represents it so well. Like you said, she didn't want this for herself. She wanted to be the vessel within which these children would grow and carry forward the vision into the world.
I think it's one of the most beautiful stories. I think there's also a lot of there's many other secrets, mystical secrets that are not even for the purview of this show to talk about it. But it's really one of my personal favorites. And I recommend that everybody check it out if you want to kind of get a feeling for where Mashiach is really going to come out of. Finally, in this week's Torah portion, Vayeshev, this is around chapter 39, book of Genesis, chapter 40 as well. Joseph goes down to Egypt. He's a successful man. He's successful in the house of Potiphar, gets involved in this bad scene with Eshet Potiphar, gets thrown into jail. That's the final thing. The famous jail episodes. Do you remember Martin Luther King's letters from Birmingham jail?
Sure, of course.
It's like there's this famous jail time, Joseph's jail time. And also in jail, he becomes a kind of an assistant jailer. He becomes one of the
Ish Matzliach. He is the successful one.
Right.
Wherever
he goes, he's successful. He starts to become a kind of one of those prisoners who gets more responsibilities. And at the end of the Torah portion, we're back to dreams again. And we're going to be in the next Torah portion, we're going to be into dreams, Pharaoh's dreams. But for now, we're going to meet another. And there's, in the end, in the Joseph story, there's three sets of two. There's his two dreams. There is really, if you want to go back to Jacob, he's got the beginning dream of the ladder, and then the ladder last dream of the speckled sheep and leaving Egypt, leaving Laban's house. You have Joseph's two dreams. You have the two dreams here of the kitchen staff, the baker and the
cupbearer.
And then finally, you're going to have Pharaoh's two dreams. That's basically the picture here. But we're going to get to the story about these two servants of Pharaoh. And one of them is going to get his job back. The other one's going to lose his head. What's that about? Why is he bumping into, like, who needs these intermediary characters in the Bible? Like, why are they important? By the way, there was one more intermediary character, which is Joseph on the way down to find his brothers gets lost, and some dude, who we know is Gavriel, the angel, but some dude in the biblical narrative helps him figure out where to go.
Right. No. Go that way.
Yeah. And you just know that there's a reason there's a person there. It's to say, like, God is watching out for this. He's looking out. Here, too, he's in jail, and there's these two dudes. What do we need them for? But they're somehow part of the narrative to lead it to the next step.
Well, I see them as coming to teach Joseph something about himself. And I don't mean that in an egoistic fashion. Because, of course, it's his willingness to help them that, in the end, teaches him about himself. That's an important distinction, right? If we look at everyone around us as sort of like bit players in our movie, then we'll never actually be able to learn anything about ourselves. But if we look at everyone around us as precious people who I need to help, and through that I'm able to learn about myself, that's how you become a tzaddik. That's how you become righteous. And that's what this is. You realize this is Yosef 2.0, right? In the beginning of the story, he talks about dreams. His brothers grab him, throw him in a pit. He doesn't get it. How do we know he doesn't get it? Because he goes down to Egypt and decides, well, hey, when you're in Egypt, you do like the Egyptians do. We talked about that already. Eshet Potiphar, he gets saved literally at the last moment by this vision. Whoop, there he goes, back into the pit. And God's basically saying, Yosef, do you get it yet? Here, let's see. Now I'll send you these two guys. And can you help them? Can you hear me, Yosef? I'm not even talking to you in your dreams anymore because that didn't go well. Right? Can you hear me through their dreams? And we see he can help them. And yet he has that last little slip at the end of the story, which shows us that he's almost there, but he's not quite. Which is that when, after the baker loses his head and the cupbearer gets his job back, Yosef, so to speak, grabs him by his coattails as he's on his way out of the jail and says, wait, don't forget about me. God says, oh, no, Yosef. Oh, you almost got it. So now you have to wait for a whole nother year. Just sit in the dark and think about what it is you actually want to be and who it is you're going to rely on. And at the risk of jumping to next week's Parsha, but since you already mentioned it, of course, the next week, Pharaoh's going to have these dreams, which we'll talk about then. And he whisks Joseph out of the pit. They clean him up. They bring him before the most powerful person in the entire world. He goes literally from the lowest to the highest in an instant. And Pharaoh says, I heard you're the guy that can interpret my dreams. Now, what would you say in that moment?
Sure, yes,
absolutely,
I am.
Sir.
Here's my card.
You know, what's the first thing Yosef says? No, it's not me.
It's God's.
Well, but the thing is, Biladai, he doesn't even get to God first. He just, it's not me. How does he know that Pharaoh's not going to look at him and say, what? You brought me along, slave? Get him out of here. But wait, no, what I really meant was it's God, not me. You know, goodbye. You see the greatness of the process he's gone through. In that moment, he's not grabbing at the coattails of the cupbearer. He knows that it's God and that this isn't his only chance to make it, as he may have thought when this butler showed up. No, no. He realizes that, I am where I mean to be. And I think that that's what's happening here.
To me also, the most amazing thing is that this Joseph is able to be that person that you're just described after having been in jail for 7 years.
Mm.
And when the call comes, when he's in the bullpen, when the call comes, he's ready to go. I would have said, oh, I've been in jail for the last 7 years. What am I, an unsuccessful shepherd? And I have emotional problems due to the fact that my family and I didn't get along, and my father loved me too much, and it was smothering me, and he gave me the special coat. My brothers hated me. I'm full of these Woody Allen little tensions in myself. And now it's power, and I've just been in darkness. Now it's light. I really can't help you, you know, in this situation. I think that's a very Jewish response. But he on the other hand, is like, I am ready to go. You know, shave, shower, change of clothes, right in front of the king. I'm ready to be at the top. And that is, to me, an amazing trait, which we have to have also in our generation, which is we're post-Holocaust, where we've got 2,000 years of baggage, and you just got to be like, oh, we're in redemption time. Sure, I can handle that.
That's so true.
No big deal. Here I am, redemption. What do you need me to do? Redemption? I'm ready for redemption.
Yeah.
And the early, some of the early Zionists were actually like they were there. Mm-hmm. Some of the early Zionists were like Trumpeldor. I'll be whatever you need me to be.
Yes.
You need me to be a woodchopper. You need to be a soldier. I'll do whatever you want because I'm a redemption man. And a lot of us are like, oh, I don't know, redemption, not redemption, this and that. And
it's a really good idea.
Is it right? How do we do a Jewish state? We got these Gentiles and we don't want to oppress them. And all these kind of like, you know, Woody Allen things. And I really see in people like him and in other people that we can see in the Bible, the amazing ability to just be at the moment and to accept the reality now and not let baggage hinder them, but let experience help them.
That's because as much as we've spoken about Yosef seeing himself as a continuation of his past, really he is the true visionary who though he is a continuation of the past, he does not let his past define his future. Right? He is wide open to the potential of what God is calling to him now.
Well, folks, lots of beautiful Torah here in Parshat Vayeshev. That is Genesis, I think about 38, 39, 40. If you're looking at the book, look at the book. It's calling to you to look at it. And I want to do a few shout-outs here. I want to thank again Jack. I want to thank also Sarah for helping be part of the show as well. I want to thank our good friend Andrew. And I want to do a shout-out to my buddy Danny down in Florida. I want to do a shout-out to Andy in Atlanta. And my good friend Eric, who is listening from Switzerland and is going to be here soon in Israel. Lots of good – and the Michel family. There's a lot of good people out there that are part of the story. Folks, I want to go out to the States and to North America in general to help connect you to the story. So if you're interested in me visiting your community, let me know. Write me an email, yishaifleischer@gmail.com. Check out our website, yishaifleischer.com. Check out – Sulam Yaakov's website,
sulamyaakov.com.
Very simple. And also both of us have a wonderful SoundCloud page. This is so that you could share it and get it out to more and more people. It changes people's lives. That's, of course, our hope. And that is our opportunity to be living this incredible life, this dream, God's dream, that is coming to fruition here in the land of Israel. Finally, it is you'll probably be hearing the next show already on Hanukkah. So I want to wish everybody happy first days of Hanukkah when you get to hear it. And we'll have a lot to say about that next week.
We sure will. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, Rabbi Mike. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
All right, folks. More great stuff is on the way. Stay tuned and Shalom.